Sakura has captured and transformed all the cards. Can she conquer the big screen? How about twice?
We're Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland. We kind of disappeared for a while. The boring reason is that we both just got overwhelmed by various things, among them the holidays. I got really set back in late October because my fiancé and I got COVID, and though that only had me down for like 2 weeks, it really set everything back and just like cascaded into everything being behind and more behind and more behind. And I'm only like now in February getting kind of back on track to normal. It also turns out it's really complicated and kind of overwhelming to plan a wedding. Woo!
Yeah, like, previously, almost every time one of us was really overwhelmed, the other one could step in and take on the mantle. And this time, like, around the time that Lucy was like, oh no, I can't really finish writing this episode, I also had a million conventions and then got a really quick turnaround book project just dropped in my lap in like whatever, September or October of last year. And it is completed, but it has not been announced, so I can't tell you anything about it. But it ate in my entire life during the holidays. So I have been very exhausted and very overworked. But it's done now, and I can think about other things, especially this podcast and actually getting to read books. It's great.
Wow. Yes, I should also say we are having a weird audio delay, so if any of this stuff doesn't sound normal, that's why. But we are persevering. Okay, before we go any further, I want everyone to go check out Wheels and Roses on Kickstarter. It's possible it has ended by the time this episode comes out, but it's a roller derby magical girl animated show, and I need it!
Yeah, it looks so spectacular. I wish them all the best. So, there are two Cardcaptor Sakura movies. They were both made by the same production team at the studio Madhouse that made the TV anime series, so just the same people. That means Morio Asaka directed them, Nanase Okawa herself wrote them, and the character designs were Kumiko Takahashi, who I goobered all over for her designs for the Tokyo Babylon OVA back at the beginning of this podcast. She was also an animation director, along with Hitoshi Ueda and Kunihiko Sakurai. I did notice while doing research that Kumiko Takahashi did key animation on Morio Asaka's directorial testing ground OVA he did for Madhouse called Pops. I think that may have been the first time they worked together. It'd be really cool to ask either of them. So the first movie came out in August of 1999, and it was released in theaters as opposed to being part of, like, a brand festival, like the Dragon Ball Z tie-in movies, which we covered in bonus episodes. This is not a completely random digression to Dragon Ball Z. That being said, it clocks in at 82 minutes, not even an hour and a half. That is short, snappy, kids anime tie-in movie territory. And spoiler alert, that is what this movie is. I couldn't find box office numbers with, like, the cursory search I did, but I imagine that wasn't the be-all end-all for this project, which was probably just as much to keep the hype train for the anime, manga, and merch going. And it definitely did well enough for them to warrant doing another one. The second one came out in 2000, actually just a little bit after the anime and manga both wrapped up. The second Cardcaptor Sakura movie, called The Sealed Card, is 98 minutes, just over an hour and a half. It also has a Leave It to Kedo short at the beginning of it, which I'm sure added some seat time for moviegoers. But actually, the first one had the Clover music video style short at the beginning of it, which I think we just don't ever get that included in video, in like home video releases. Wow, I'm still calling it a home video release, not a Blu-ray release. Oh my goodness. But that Clover music video, obviously we will be discussing soon when we get through Clover, but it was also later released on the Clamp and Wonderland 2 collection. Again, we're going to skip this for now, but that is when it would have been released. Anyway, both movies actually won an award. I mean, they each won the same award in their respective years. The Theatrical Film Award at Animation Kobe, which is sadly defunct as of 2015, but was founded in 1996 by Kobe City. Well, by some amount of Kobe officials that helped organize a committee of anime industry folks, mostly magazine editors, it looks like, people from New Type and Animedia, so they could have a nice big event in the city. Previous Theatrical Film Awards were given to Production IG's Ghost in the Shell, directed by the eminent Mamoru Oshii, Hayao Miyazaki's film for Studio Ghibli, Princess Mononoke, and then, like, the Pokemon movie. So take that how you will. They also did give TV anime awards to Evangelion, Utena, Cowboy Bebop, and eventually to Clamp Relevant, Angelic Layer, and Code Geass. The music for both Cardcaptor Sakura movies is wonderful. The soundtracks are by Takayuki Negishi, just like the rest of the series. There are, of course, Image Song, you know, pop song tie-ins as well. In the first movie, you have Naoki Kaitani's In the Distant City, and movie two has a Distant Melody by Chaka. The voice cast is, of course, the same, with additions for new characters, such as pop star and voice actress Maya Sakamoto, who was in the accelerated beginning of her, you know, illustrious career. She provided the voice of the Nothing Card. She had also sung Platinum for the TV anime's third theme song, another note in her long association with Clamp and their productions. According to an interview she did of Clamp for her radio show back in 2010, thank you Chibi Yuto on SakamotoMaya.com, they said they didn't actually meet until the song she did for Clamp School Detectives, though, because, quote-unquote, they didn't go to any parties back then. I'm paraphrasing. And I can't help but speculate that that had to do with how grueling their schedules were, because Nanase Okawa wrote these in the middle of writing everything else that they were doing. Anyway, for 18 years, this second movie was the last Cardcaptor Sakura primary media that Clamp released to fans. But in 2018, the second movie was re-released to U.S. theaters for the first time, in a limited special release, but still, I'm sure as part of the campaign to hype up Clear Card, which started running in that year. But we will pretend that we don't know about it for now.
Yeah, Clear Card what, huh? I don't know her. Alrighty, so, movie one. It opens with Sakura and crew fighting the arrow. It's a pretty impressive fight, and for us, serves as a good way to ground us in the right era of the series, as well as watching the animation team show off what they can do with the budget. This movie takes place before the judgment by Yue, so Mei Ling is still around, Sakura's still collecting cards, and her relationship with Shaodan is still one of rivalry and grudging respect.
That night, as Sakura sleeps, the deck of clue cards glows. In her dream, Sakura is in a flooded warehouse, and as she looks down into the water, ribbons flow up and pull her down into the depths. And as the ribbons release her and she sinks down, a voice says, "Water is a thing that flows." Creepy. The animation team really brings these ribbons to elegant, terrifying life, reminiscent of Nataku's ribbon weapons in the X movie. That and the stark, lonely darkness of this scene really brought us back to darker Clamp works like X.
The next day, the kids are receiving their grades before leaving for winter break. Sakura was a little nervous that her grade would have dropped, it didn't, but her nerves were nothing compared to Shaodan. After a tense few minutes, he finally sees his grades and breathes a sigh of relief. These he can show his mother. So apparently Shaodan desperately wants to impress, or at least appease, his mother. I wonder if this will be relevant information later. After school, Tomoyo and Sakura go to Twin Bells, you remember the little shop with the stuffed animals and the fake clue cards, to buy a notebook. They are having a giveaway, and wouldn't you know it, Sakura wins a trip to Hong Kong! What are the odds?
Actually pretty good, because when she reaches into the box for the random drawing, there's definitely magic shit afoot as we see the grand prize-winning ball drawn magically to her hand. Of course, Sakura has no idea and is just thrilled to be leaving the country for the first time.
And it so happens that her dad will be out of town that week, so guess who gets to take her? Toya! And naturally, Yukito and Tomoyo will join them. But wait, won't we still be missing half our cast? I'll give it time. They bring Kero along in Sakura's purse. I guess he shows up as a stuffed animal on security scans? Like, maybe it's, I mean, it's 1999, so maybe bags didn't get x-rayed at that point? I was 12 and had never flown, so I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, my memory about pre-9/11 is, like, I did fly on airplanes that I still don't remember, but definitely airport security is much more chill. Or maybe just don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. He, that is Kero, is excited to see good old Hong Kong again, and of course recognizes exactly none of it because of how much the city has changed in however many years it's been. However, he says the presence is still the same. The magic is diluted in Japan, but here it feels nostalgic to him.
Also, Kato is buying none of this randomly want a trip to Hong Kong nonsense and explains Clo's theory that there are no coincidences in this world. I will not accrue a stargazing point here, but just know that I could. Kato doesn't hold his serious face for long and proclaims that it could have no connection. Maybe he's just letting the atmosphere of the city get to him.
But really, stay on alert, kids, okay?
To highlight this for the viewer, Sakura, Tomoyo, and Kato are being watched at that very moment by two very mystical-looking birds.
And in the next scene, we're back in Sakura's dream, with the warehouse and the water. This time, the same birds are perched above her watching.
Definitely mystical birds.
She also sees a lady in flowing robes, with ribbons swirling around her. The ribbons float down to Sakura as if inviting her to grab them. Sakura reaches out, but wakes up reaching for her ceiling, back in bed in her hotel room.
The kids are definitely enjoying Hong Kong. There's a cute scene where they all go out for dim sum, and Kato's almost caught by Toya when he sneaks food from the baskets. Honestly, there are a lot of cute little moments of them seeing the city, which we're gonna jump over for the sake of time.
On one of their excursions, they go to Bird Street, a place where many birds are for sale in cages. Yukito says the people of the city take their birds for walks in cages here, and Kato explains, though not to Yukito, of course, because Ruri doesn't know anything yet, that this area hasn't changed much over the years. Sakura is admiring cute birds when she senses a disturbance in the forest. Is someone watching her? Kato senses it too, but doesn't think it's a Clo card. It feels more evil than that.
That's when Sakura spots our two mystical birds. They fly away and Sakura takes off after them, chasing them through the city using jump. She ends up at an old well, nestled between office buildings. The area around it looks run down, with slabs of broken concrete, but the well itself is pristine. Sakura stares into it, and although at first it's clear and she can see rocks at the bottom, the surface shifts as she turns away. The ribbons from her dream float towards the surface and Sakura's eyes go glassy, again, wonderfully animated.
She almost falls in, but is saved by none other than Shaodan, who appears and yells at her to wake up. Well, she's saved from being pulled under by mystical ribbons, that is, she still falls into the well, but it's shallow and only a bit inconvenient. Back at the Bird Street, Tomoyo also runs into a familiar face, or rather, Mei Ling literally runs into her.
So the gang is all back together.
Side note, it's very weird to me that they clearly did not tell their friends, who are from Hong Kong, that they were going to Hong Kong. Like, even if they aren't super close, it seems like a thing you would obviously do. Maybe they tried calling their house, but they'd already, like, left Japan for Hong Kong. This is before cell phones or social media, after all, so there were limited ways to, like, get in touch with friends outside of school. And I can't remember if they'd given Shaodan a special cell phone at this point or not.
Yeah, that didn't happen till episode 53 in the last season. So, I do think this feels a little like loose writing, though. Since they didn't even mention, gee, it would be nice to get in touch with our friends here for a local tour. This is another don't think about it moment.
Anyway, they all meet up and get to go back with Shaodan and Mei Ling to the Li household. They're all given new clothes, Sakura because she fell in the well, but everyone else just because they wanted to draw cute outfits, I guess. They're also beset by Shaodan's four older sisters, who find the girls adorable, but find the teenage boys even more so. Sorry, gals.
It's all fun and games until a very imposing woman enters the room, Shaodan's mother. She immediately identifies Sakura as the one with the Clo cards and invites them all to spend the night. Shaodan is not pleased by this, but really has no choice, and Toya and Yukito are distracted by the sisters' attention, so they're no help. Shaodan's mom is not the only one who can sense things, though. Later that night, Sakura tells Tomoyo and Kato that she can sense an energy from Mrs. Li, and Kato says she's clearly a descendant of Clo Reed. He also reminds us that Clo's mother's family were famous sorcerers in China, and gives some more exposition that feels wildly unneeded to us who are watching this after the whole series, but was probably very informative to a viewer who hadn't gotten to the Judgment yet, let alone Ariel.
That night in the Li household, Sakura has the dream again. She's in the warehouse, with the mysterious woman floating over her, tendrils of ribbon surrounding her. This time, Sakura grabs one of the ribbons, and the voice says, "I've waited for you forever." The ribbons latch onto Sakura's wrist and draw her up to the lady. She dangles from her wrists as the lady moves ominously towards her, and then she wakes up. Kato and Tomoyo are looking over her, and Kato has been saying her name. They realize she has marks on her wrist from where the ribbons grabbed her.
And Shaodan's mom knocks on the door. She takes Sakura outside and activates a Nashinban compass similar to the one Shaodan uses to locate cards. This tells her that Sakura was beckoned to Hong Kong by the woman in her dream. She warns her that a great danger is approaching, and that those with great power are susceptible to the temptation of evil. This includes Sakura, since she has the power of the claw. But there is also the potential for guidance. The evil is coming from a dream, but the help she needs is also within a dream. As the magic fades, Shaoran's mother tells Sakura that she knows she is capable of finding the answer.
The next day, Sakura and her crew leave their house, but as she's about to go, Shaoran's mother kisses Sakura on the cheek, to Shaoran's complete surprise and probably embarrassment. She also tells Sakura to beware of water. Mei Ling and Shaoran play tour guide for the group, while the kids puzzle over everything that has happened, and Toya and Yukito enjoy the sights. Sakura finds a cute hair ornament that reminds her of the dream lady, and it gains even more significance when Yukito sees her admiring it and buys it for her.
The mood quickly shifts when Sakura spots the two birds again, spying on them. She takes off after them with Kero in tow and her friends far behind, eventually being led to a storefront. When she walks in, she sees a number of ornate vases and other antiques, but many things look like they're packaged for storage. Then she hears ominous dripping coming from a book. On the cover of the book is the woman from Sakura's dreams, sitting at the well she encountered the other day. Her eyes go glassy again, and a voice says, "Come." Kero fights to keep Sakura from opening the book and is on the verge of biting her to wake her up when Toya and the rest burst in. Toya shakes Sakura awake, but she also drops the book, and water starts flowing out of it.
The room floods with water, and everyone else seems to disappear. Sakura swims upwards, surfacing in the strange warehouse from her dream. Fortunately, Kero has also managed to stay with her. Like the dream, the woman appears above them and the two birds fly to her, and turn into her ribbons. Lovely visual. Kero recognizes her from the front of the book, and of course Sakura recognizes her from her dreams, but the woman is none too happy to see them. Apparently, they were not who she was expecting.
She comes at them, and Sakura uses fly to avoid her watery attacks. The woman recognizes the use of claw cards, first from Sakura and then from Shaoran. He appeared here after the water swallowed him, but it looks like everyone else has been captured. They are being held in spherical prisons by the lady and appear to be unconscious. The lady, still pretty pissed, asks why they're here. She called for Chloe Reed. Where is he? Kero finds her very familiar, but there's no time to ponder that now, as Sakura and Shaoran go on the offensive to try and rescue their friends. Shaoran uses Storm to trap the enemy in a waterspout. Sakura breaks Tomoyo out of her sphere using the sword card and flies her out of immediate danger, but when Shaoran tries to break Mei Ling out, his own sword does nothing.
Before Sakura can go back for more of them, the enemy breaks out of the water spout. Shaoran tells Sakura to escape on her own. The lady's magic is weaker above, so they should be able to escape that way. Sakura tries to get to him, but Shaoran is captured in a sphere prison, and he implores her to run. And although it pains her to leave everyone, Sakura manages to get herself, Kero, and Tomoyo away. But before they leave, the lady says that if Chloe Reed won't come to her, she'll go out and find him.
Sakura, Tomoyo, and Kero reappear in the old shop where they found the book. As they appear, a clock starts ticking again, implying that they were somewhere outside of time. The book is gone now. But at least Kero remembers why that lady looked so familiar. She used to be a fortune teller here in Hong Kong, a long time ago. Her medium for fortune telling was water, and she would make things appear on its surface. She had a good reputation, but when Chloe Reed showed up, he started taking away her customers. That bitch. As a result, she challenged him to fights. Kero theorizes that she must have transferred her consciousness and magic to the book when she died. Her hatred for Chloe Reed remained. It seems reasonable. She was likely trying to trap him in the book, not realizing he's long dead. She got Sakura instead because she has the claw cards.
In order to get everyone back, they'll need to find an alternate entrance to her dimension. Of course, Sakura remembers the cover of the book and the well she encountered earlier. That night, with Sakura in costume, at Tomoyo's insistence, of course, they return to the well. There's a force field around it this time, so they can't get close. But Shaoran's mom appears and uses her powers to create an opening just long enough for Sakura and Kero to go through. They float down, and Kero announces that they are in a dimension tunnel. If they don't find the right place, they could be lost here forever. Sakura has to use her powers to sense those she loves and follow that feeling to the correct dimension. She emerges in a version of Hong Kong and immediately sees the ominous birds. They lead her on a chase through the Phantom City.
We get some fun jazzy chase music, and they eventually find a door that takes them to the chamber Sakura has seen so many times in her dreams. The lady is there, and they try to tell her that Chloe Reed is dead, but she's not listening to them. She's been waiting for Chloe Reed forever. To make matters worse, her chamber is starting to collapse. Giant stone pillars fall around them, and the lady disappears with the spherical prisons containing their friends. Outside, Shaodan's mom and Tomoyo brace for impact as the well explodes and a pillar of red light shoots into the sky. She's gone to find Chloe Reed, leaving Sakura and Kero in her collapsing chamber.
Fortunately, Sakura is also magic and uses fly to get them to safety. They blast out of the well, back in our dimension, and fly above the city, doing battle with the fortune teller. She blasts them with water as Sakura tries to avoid her attacks, but is eventually caught by her ribbons. Because this is Clamp, and it is 1999, they are doing battle in a skyscraper that's under construction. You know, lots of exposed beams and scaffolding. Sound familiar? Sakura is finally able to tell her that Chloe Reed is dead, but the fortune teller doesn't want to believe it, and her fury continues in water attacks on the area. She's determined to wait for him forever and says that he would never die. She floods the area with water, submerging Sakura, but it looks like the fact he really is gone may be sinking in, no pun intended. Underwater, Sakura struggles against the ribbons trapping her when she sees a strange light and is able to see some of the fortune teller's memories. Chloe Reed brought her a gift, the hairpiece Sakura noticed earlier. Maybe what she felt for Chloe Reed wasn't hatred, but love?
As Sakura struggles, Chloe Reed's voice says, "Water is a thing that flows." This prompts an idea, and she's able to activate the arrow card that she caught in the beginning of the movie. It breaks the seals, freeing the water to rush down the side of the building, releasing Sakura. She confronts the fortune teller and asks if she actually loved Chloe Reed. Sakura understands. It hurts to lose someone you love. With no choice but to accept what has happened, the fortune teller begins to disappear, her form turning into droplets of water. She just wanted to see Chloe Reed again, to tell him something.
All that's left behind is her headpiece, and looking at it, Sakura remembers Chloe's words, that water is something that flows. The headpiece shatters, and Sakura's friends return. After everything, they try to enjoy their last day in Hong Kong. Sakura has taken a lesson from this. She wants to share her feelings with the person she loves one day, too. But not today, because we have a whole nother 30 episodes or whatever before that can happen.
Alright, so, movie 2, The Sealed Card, released weeks after the TV anime ended, and if you recall, it ended without as clear a love confession as the manga had, this movie opens in an abandoned mansion. It is Ariel and Chloe's old house. Through a hole in the floorboards, you can see a card glowing. A Chloe card. After the title screen, we jump to Sakura mid-adventure at the King Penguin slide, with Yue and Kero both in their full form, helping out. We get to see her activate the jump card, showing off some great animation. She's battling a series of giant creatures, using plenty of her cards to combat them. There's a flaming dragon, an elephant made of stone, a big tree monster. It is an epic battle.
So epic, in fact, because it's actually one of Tomoyo's films! She even edited epic music in and everything, and Sakura used the Create card to generate the monsters. Sakura's a bit embarrassed, but of course Kero thinks he looks very cool in the recording they're watching. This is a cute moment that helps ground us in their world now. The anime has ended, Sakura's transformed all the Chloe cards into Sakura cards, Ariel's gone home, and despite all her powers and adventures, Sakura is still a relatively normal sixth grader. Speaking of things that haven't changed, when Shaodan comes up in the conversation, Sakura gets all blushy and drifts into her own little world. Apparently he's been gone for 4 months, but Sakura's feelings for him remain as strong as ever.
Tomoyo sees that Sakura's thinking about him, which becomes pretty unavoidable when he's on the screen in some unedited footage that's still playing, and Sakura observes that Tomoyo knew all along how Shaodan felt about her. It was pretty much just Sakura who took a long time to realize it. Tomoyo says that Shaodan probably likes her precisely because she can be so oblivious, which may be true, but apparently Sakura still hasn't answered him after he confessed his feelings to her. It has been 4 months. Poor boy! See, Sakura wants to respond to him in person, not over the phone or by letter, since he confessed his feelings to her in person, which is pretty sweet of her.
Next, we've got a familiar scene of Sakura rushing to get ready for school. Apparently they are getting ready for the Dadeshiko Festival today. Class is putting on a play, and Sakura will be the princess. Remember that Nadeshiko is her mother's name, and also a beautiful flower that has some symbolic significance in Japan, but not usually a national holiday or anything. This is a local event. As she packs her bag, Sakura grabs the Sakura cards, and looks at the mysterious card she got at the end of the anime. But there's no time to waste thinking about cosmically important magic stuff. She has a breakfast to rush through and a brother to argue with.
This scene is familiar to the point of almost being annoying. Toy even teases her for being a monster, and well, we've seen this before, but it does help us get up to speed. Sakura's been working on this play through summer vacation, and she's pretty excited about it. And remember, the Nadeshiko Festival is a community affair, so everyone will be there. Toya will even be there helping his university run an ice cream parlor.
Naturally, Yukito will be there too. He apparently goes to the same university as Toya. I am for some reason surprised and delighted that he got into university, but who knows what kind of, like, crazy knowledge he has via Yue, via Chloe Reed, so it's probably not surprising.
Anyway, the whole town is decorating for this festival, and this only encourages Sakura to try hard in her rehearsal. It's Naoko's script.
Aww.
And she's playing opposite Yamazaki-kun's prince. But the fictional confession of love strikes a little close to home. Poor Sakura. I hope you get to see Shadon again soon. As Tomoyo and Sakura walk home, we learn that at least one thing has changed. Apparently, an amusement park is being built where Ariel's house used to be, hence the opening scene. I'm sure nothing could possibly go wrong with this.
While Sakura is practicing lines that evening and missing Shadon, we get a closer look at this amusement park. There's a mysterious figure lurking there. A girl with long, curly brown hair and wings that look they're coming out of the back of her head?
See, everything is normal here. Nothing's going wrong.
Sakura and Tomoyo visit the amusement park during the day, and almost immediately Sakura senses something. She takes off and ends up running smack dab into Shadon, and Mei Ling is right behind him. Apparently, they wanted to surprise everyone, so they didn't tell them they were coming to Japan. They've even planned to stay for the Nadeshiko Festival, which means they'll get to see the play. And Mei Ling whispers conspiratorially to Sakura that her engagement to Shadon is officially broken off. There's some girl he likes, but he's still waiting to hear how she feels.
Hmm.
Oh, and Tomoyo totally instigated this whole thing by inviting them to Japan while their vacations overlapped, coincidentally right in time for the festival. They are even staying with her. Tomoyo sees all!
Speaking of machinations, Sakura invites them both to have dinner at her place, but Mei Ling announces she has plans with Tomoyo, who agrees without missing a beat, and therefore Shadon will have to go to Sakura's place for dinner alone.
These kids, my god. If you can't own up to your feelings, they will wingman your asses together.
Sakura and Shadon have a painfully awkward moment at her house as she tries to make him tea and almost tells him how she feels, but of course she's interrupted by Kero, who senses the sweets that went along with the tea.
We've still got, like, 3/4 of this movie to go. It can't happen that easily.
Hmm. It could. Anyway, Kenno is the opposite of Tomoyo and seems completely clueless about what he has interrupted. There is a good bit where he transforms into his full form so he can bully Shadon while Sakura's making dinner. Kenno does return upstairs after dinner, but Sakura is again interrupted when she tries to talk to Shadon, this time by her brother and Yukito. She has to see him off without finishing her statement, but Shadon does confirm he'll see her at school tomorrow. He wants to say hi to everyone working on the play. As Sakura watches him leave, Kenno sleeps upstairs, not noticing as one of the Sakura cards, the change card, floats out of the deck, glowing, and then vanishes. The card appears in front of Princess Emerald, I mean, the mysterious girl from earlier who doesn't look at all like Princess Emerald, in the theme park.
Gasp! At school the next day, everyone is happy to see Shadon and Mei Ling, and delighted that they'll be here for the festival. Mei Ling is a little frustrated that their evil plan clearly did not lead to Sakura answering Shadon's confession, but Tomoyo isn't bothered. In fact, this just means there is still a chance she'll be able to record the whole thing, like a normal friend. After school, Sakura, Tomoyo, Mei Ling, and Shadon go home together. Mei Ling does chastise Sakura a bit, but also tries to encourage her. She just needs to show courage!
It's summer in Japan, so it's swelteringly hot, so Sakura suggests they go to a juice place she knows. It's really close, they just have to turn at a mailbox at the next street. When they get to the street, there is no sign of the mailbox. And ominously, we see what looks like a cut-off post just kind of begin to glow. The kids are off to get juice, though, so they don't notice. Back home, Kero wants Sakura to write Ariel a letter telling Supi about his video game prowess. Sakura uses the framing of a letter to Ariel to sum up things for the viewer, much like she used to do with letters to Mizuki-sensei. She falls asleep, and another card floats out of the deck, glows, and disappears.
Next, we get a montage of the kids getting ready for the play, and Sakura trying and failing to talk to Shadon. It concludes with Mei Ling and Tomoyo leaving Sakura and Shadon alone again, hoping something will happen, but it doesn't. They are interrupted by a giant rabbit that looks like Ushagi from Wish, which turns out to be Toya in a mascot costume. At least Yukito seems aware of what they've interrupted, which is funny, because I guess he just lived through a whole season of this. They all get ice cream, and Yukito and Sakura get a moment alone while Yukito gives her advice about how to confess her feelings to the person she likes. Even this conversation can't go too far, though, because another card disappears from Sakura's backpack, and this time she does notice something is weird.
She mentions it later to Shaodan, but he hasn't noticed anything. Well, except that the bridge on their route has disappeared. It doesn't look like it collapsed. It looked like a big part of it was just mysteriously cut away without leaving any debris, just like the mailbox we saw earlier. Oh well, the kids decide to go to the amusement park the next day. How exciting! Of course, this is a perfect opportunity for Sakura and Shaodan to be awkward and Tomoyo and Mei-Ling to spy on them. They also get to ride a bunch of rides, which is fun. Time for another montage.
Again, Mei-Ling arranges things so that Sakura and Shaodan end up alone together on the Ferris wheel car. Maybe they will finally talk?
They almost do, but another car does its disappearing trick, and this time both kids notice. As soon as they're off the Ferris wheel, they take off after it, and then end up at a funhouse.
Shaodan confirms Sakura's suspicions. They are definitely sensing a clue card. He doesn't know how that could be, though, since she has already captured all the cards, like, a whole season ago. The mysterious headwing lady finally appears in front of them. They are thrown off a bit by the funhouse mirrors, and Sakura decides to use the through card to make their way, but the card is gone. Finally, the girl talks. She says, "Give me back my friends," and more of Sakura's cards zoom out of her bag. Sakura tries to attack with Woody, but it does no good, and the girl disappears. So at least now we know what's up. This girl is stealing cards!
Just as Sakura and Kero are puzzling things out that evening, they get a call from Ariel. He explains that there was a card sealed underneath his mansion, and since the mansion has been destroyed, it'll start to act. This card has never been used, and only Chloe Reed knew of its existence. While each of the Chloe cards have a positive energy, used to bring things into creation, this card is different. It brings everything to a state of nothingness. It has the power to make everything disappear. Kero asks why Chloe would create such a dangerous card, and Ariel explains that with so many cards with positive energy, there had to be one to balance them with negative energy. Kero points out this is, you know, like the concept of yin and yang, and also connects the dots and realizes that means this one card is as powerful as all 52 of the other cards put together.
Apparently, this was all fine and good when all the cards were Chloe cards, but now that the 52 main cards are Sakura cards, the one remaining negative Chloe card is, well, freaking the fuck out! My words, not his. Why wasn't this very important information conveyed to us before now? Well, because Ariel doesn't have all of Chloe Reed's memories, obviously.
Sure, okay. Don't think about it.
So the girl is obviously the card, and she's taking the Sakura cards back, along with random buildings and stuff. Every time the negative card takes away a Sakura card, something else will disappear as well. Things, places, or even people.
If Sakura doesn't transform this card into a Sakura card, everything will disappear. But in order to capture it, Sakura will have to trade the most important feeling she has at the time.
Oh no!
Maybe Ariel has some more useful information, but the call cuts off. Apparently, the card sensed Ariel and made the phone line disappear.
Sakura fills Shaodan in on everything later, and he basically tells her she has to seal it. She has no choice. If she doesn't sacrifice her most important feeling, everything will disappear. Sakura runs through the rain crying and literally runs into Yukito, who totally knows he's Yue now. I just have to emphasize that because I keep forgetting.
Yeah, no, we skipped like a year between these two movies.
Yeah. Yue is worried about her, but at least has some advice. He doesn't think Chloe would have created something that would only bring calamity.
I am less convinced.
So there must be a way for her to seal it without losing her most important feeling. Sakura is at school when another card is stolen, and this time they can see the girl floating in her ball in the sky. A big chunk of the soccer field disappears, but even worse, Yamazaki hurt himself when he fell! But they can't cancel the play. Who could possibly take his place?
Shaodan, of course. Tomoyo sings at the festival, and Sakura preps for the play, all while the mysterious card watches from above. Fujitaka makes it to the play as well, and ends up sitting next to Sonomi, Tomoyo's mother, who has her small army of lady bodyguards filming every performance, of course.
And we get to see their play! It's cute, and Sakura is wearing one of her iconic outfits. It's like the long white dress. It leads to lots of cute interactions between Sakura and Shaodan, including a lovely dance together. In the play, Shaodan the prince confesses his feelings to Sakura the princess, prompting lots of emotions from all involved, including their friends backstage. But before the scene can end, the lights explode! They are under attack from the sealed card. Who could have foreseen this?
Yeah, almost like maybe they should have canceled the play, or maybe stayed up late and taken care of this, you know, everything disappearing problem before the play. But you know what? Don't think about it. Large areas start disappearing, including most of our recognizable characters. Sakata's dad and Tomoyo's mom, their friends, even Toya are engulfed by the nothing. Viewers of a certain age or who are well-read in German children's novels might be reminded of the meta-antagonistic force in The Neverending Story, but I digress. Yue and Kero manage to escape, as well as Mei Ling and Tomoyo, but really this all comes down to Sakata. She has to seal it. But Shaodan will go with her.
And of course, Tomoyo gives them new outfits. More of Sakata's cards are stolen away, and Sakata tries to fight using Windy, but predictably it doesn't do any good, and Windy is swept up with the other cards. No pun intended, but I enjoyed it. Sakata only has a handful of cards left. Tomoyo and Mei Ling also get taken, but Kato and Yue have figured out where the card is. The amusement park! Who could have known?
Once at the amusement park, they're attacked by various things. The horses from the carousel run at them, and a pirate ship almost crushes them. A roller coaster almost hits Sakata until she uses time to stop it. They are able to spot the girl, the sealed card, right, floating in the sky. Yue and Kero attempt to attack her, but it doesn't do any good, and Sakata's still losing cards. And ultimately, they are both consumed, leaving just Sakata and Shaodan.
Shaolin concludes that the cards and the Guardians of Chloride will not work against this card, and he decides to mount his own attack. He chases her up the Ferris wheel with some rocking electric guitar in the background, and his thunder does seem to be hurting her, but ultimately her power is much stronger, and Shaodan too disappears. Now it's just Sakata and her few remaining cards.
She's sad, but she's determined to never give up. She flies after the girl, chasing her up a clock tower, until the sealed card takes fly, causing Sakata to fall to the ground. She tries using shield, and the girl takes that too. Sakata chases the girl up the tower, telling her that she is determined to seal her away and get everyone back. The card protests. She was locked away for so long, and now she finally has her friends back. Why is Sakata interfering with her?
Sakata responds that the cards are not her friends. Friendship doesn't mean you do whatever you want with someone. She's completely wrong. And at that, the cards appear around the girl as if judging her. She asks why they hate her, why they won't be with her. But the cards just leave, forming a path so that Sakata can walk over to her.
Sakata tells her it'll be okay. She will be able to join everyone. And her magic circle appearing before her, she asks the card to return to her true form and be sealed away as a new Sakata card. The card gives in, transforming, and Sakata looks sad, realizing she never had a chance to tell Shaodan her feelings before she's about to lose them.
Speaking of Shaodan, he's there too, having resisted the nothing somehow. Instead of going to Sakata, the card's aura wraps around him. Since Sakata used up so much of her magic when she lost all the cards, he apparently registers as having more magic, so the card went to him, and so did the consequences. But even if his feelings for her are lost, he'll still...
Oh, but of course he disappears before he can finish that sentence.
Sakata is distraught, but there's one card she forgot about, the mysterious blank card with a winged heart on it. It activates, and after a flash of light, Shaodan is back, and a cute voice tells Sakata that everything will be alright.
The card has a name now, the Hope, and the girl is in this card now, holding the winged heart. Sakata tells Shaodan that she doesn't mind if he doesn't have feelings for her anymore. She loves him. He's the one she loves the most. Shaodan looks at her blankly, but then he says, "Me too." Maybe he didn't have to pay the toll after all because of the fusion, or maybe he fell in love with her all over again.
The sun rises, the music swells, and we made it through this movie! Everyone wakes up back in reality, so that's good. And Sakata and Shaodan finally confirmed their feelings for each other. Hurrah!
All right. So, as you may have guessed from our snarky interjections, I don't want to say that these are bad. They're not bad. That is not what they are. Visual feast, light story for both of them. But let's talk about the first one first. I did really like seeing Shaodan's family. I feel like it explains a lot about him, and we never really get to see them in anything else.
Yeah, that was a treat. I think the first movie definitely stands out for me partially because of that reason. Like, we get a lot of information. Granted, it's weird to have a movie all about how dead Chloe Reed is and then go on to have an entire season about how not really all that dead he is. But I guess it does set him and his background up more, which is helpful going into that next arc.
Yeah, if you were watching this mid-season, it would probably be tantalizing instead of slightly annoying. But it does kind of have this, like, man, Ariel exists. Why would the fortune teller be reaching out to Sakura, not Ariel? Like, look, there are problems.
Yeah, like, if they were trying to parallel the fortune teller losing Chloe to Sakura understanding loss, why didn't they bring up her mom at all? Like, that seems like an obvious connection that we make, but why not weave that into the actual story?
Yeah, this reminds me of, like, the weird feeling a lot of specials and movies for serialized media will get. Maybe even especially in the 80s and 90s, when we were kids. Like, they're not allowed to use all the elements from the show or something, maybe in an attempt to make it accessible for a new viewer who isn't a fan yet, but it ends up feeling like a weird alternative universe where everything's kind of simpler, or in a less diegetic phrasing, like the writers didn't know all the lore. But that cannot be the case here, because the writing credit for this goes to Nanase Okawa herself, and like, this is stuff that she signed off on and wanted in the movie. I don't think they were trying to make this movie more accessible, by the way, because it really is just an extended episode arc with a decent budget. It doesn't spend a lot of time re-explaining things, and it doesn't specifically leave things out to try to, like, re-establish its premise or simplify. I think it's just a little sloppy.
Yeah, seriously, back to parallels, they could have at least connected the fortune teller's loss theme with her fighting to get her friends back, like Sakura's friends. I'd almost forgotten that was happening until they reappeared.
Yeah, okay. It's not that, me too, and it's not that long enough of a movie to, like, get lost in the convolutions. It's more like it just didn't keep focus. It's also, it really suffers, and really both of the movies suffer from something that we kind of noticed being a problem in the anime sometimes too, where, like, they sort of, there's a lot of things that could have all just happened at once, but instead they're like these really discrete scenes from each other, right? Like, how many times did Sakura need to have one of those dreams before we could figure out what was going on? Like, she didn't get that much more information each time. It felt really repetitive. And it felt weird to be, like, pushed. They were kind of, like, pushed out of the fortune teller's dimension, like, more than once, only to discover basically the same thing each time. like when she said, oh, I must find Chloe Reed myself, like, why not? That should have been when she tried to escape, like, not that you come back and then she tries to escape. Like, it definitely feels like there's issues with the pacing where everything could have been kind of happening all at once rather than, like, paced out for these really discrete different sections.
Yeah, definitely. Overall, I don't think this is an amazing movie, but it's a fun romp and it's nice to see them all in a new location.
Yeah, sections of it kind of feel like a 1999 travel ad for Hong Kong. Extremely beautiful background paintings and shots that sell the beauty of the place and the excitement the kids are feeling exploring it. I sort of assume Hong Kong was chosen for the Reed, Chloe Reed Lee family's home and therefore this movie's setting, at least partially because of the rich output of films made by Hong Kong directors and industry that Clamp would have had access to. So, like, maybe inspired by, like, Shaodan himself feels, you know, inspired by fantastical martial arts films and stuff. Not like they need an excuse to set anything in any particular place. Like, places exist. People are from there. That's another reason to use them. But I definitely feel the, like, there is a little bit of that kind of, like, oh, martial arts movie, you know, drama to this. Especially, like, historical martial arts movie. But the fact that the city is so shaped by water around and through it, it makes the water theme of the villainess feel really fitting. And she has, like, very beautiful kind of traditional elements in her costuming. And, like, all of that is just, it's really gorgeous. Like, that part is, like, yeah, it's worth sort of, like, watching this for how beautifully made it is. But maybe not for how tightly written it is. The second movie, I'd say, is even more visual beauty over story substance, if that is possible.
Yeah, so Robin mentioned the snarkiness of some of our script. It was about, like, 90% snarkier before I edited it, because I was having a real time when I was writing that second movie script. So I watched this like 2 months after we originally watched it to write that summary because of all of the things we discussed at the top that set stuff back. And I had managed in those 2 months to forget pretty much everything about the second movie. It is mostly just redoing stuff from the series, but kind of worse.
So mean, but yeah. It has a lot of repetition, so much repetition within the movie, and like mostly stuff from the series too. As in, the movie has repetitive scenes as well as repeating stuff from the series. Sorry, to be clear.
Yeah, and this movie just super dragged for me. I remember being really excited for it as a teen, but it feels like nothing happens in it. Honestly, this would have been much better as an episode or two than a full movie, because there's not much original content here. The first part of this movie can easily be summed up as, do you remember anything about the show? You liked it when Sakura fought with her brother and Kato played video games and the kids put on a play, right? We'll hear that all is again, and something is happening with the cards, maybe.
Yeah, and the second half is, what if the emptiness you feel waiting for these kids to do something that they've already done in the manga manifested into an entire quote card? And that kind of sucks, because this movie, I think, is a gift to the fans at the time. A way to make the big finale of these two characters confessing to each other, like, not just, like, taking that and making it not just a two-episode arc or something in the series, but a theatrically released feature film. Like, that's really sweet. That's a really cool idea. And maybe it worked for fans in full hype mode at the moment. I mean, I know there is an anecdote from one of the Puff magazine interviews that Clamp gave right after Sakura ended, where they said, and this is very much a they said they heard, not a first-person recollection, that a young male theater audience member was overheard saying, if they kill Shaodan, I'll die too. And they speculated a bit about whether that was feeling really connected to Shaodan, like they were also a boy and loved that deeply, or whether it was that kid was so into Sakura that they were identifying him. Identifying with him for that reason. But that kind of reminds me to put on fan goggles to try to understand why this movie might be the way it is. Because otherwise, I certainly wouldn't have made it this way myself. It takes an important beat that is an important beat, that is something that you would be waiting for if you were just watching the anime, and it stretches it out way too much.
So speaking of that, I'm pretty sure in the manga, Sakura's conversation with Shaodan was something she carefully worked up to. She wanted to treat him with respect. It was a big deal, and it was given full weight. In this, they are giving it weight by denying it until the end, but it feels like the opposite of thoughtful respect. It feels like everyone is begging Sakura to act, including us, and she just refuses for really no good reason. Like, I'd understand that behavior if maybe it had been, like, a couple days since he confessed and she was still figuring things out. But it has been 4 months, and she made a big deal about wanting to tell him to his face. His face has been here for a week! Freaking talk already! I'm not saying that's not somewhat realistic, but it feels really forced after, like, the fifth mysterious interruption. Much like how the anime had to drag out Toya and Yukito having a 5-minute conversation, this had to drag out Sakura's confession because it needs to be part of the climax. But it's not even mysterious. We know they both like each other. It's just frustrating and makes you care less about the outcome, or at least to me, care less about the outcome.
Yeah, realistic is one thing. In fiction, we need pacing. We need tension to build and we need releases. That constant teasing is super not compelling for me either. And I think that in the show, the fact that you would come home from school and watch an episode, maybe every day, maybe once a week, depending on how it's being shown, wherever you are, like, that pacing makes sense, that you need to sort of, like, hint the same things over and over again. So, you know, on the one hand, the way that, you know, material is made for streaming and binging these days definitely means that we don't, you know, don't have to hammer home that kind of repetition quite as much. It definitely means that doing it in a movie where you are sitting there for an hour and a half and that's all you're doing, it definitely makes that weirder. It's not super comfy.
Yeah, in its defense a little, I will say that at that age group, I think I was more tolerant and excited about that long, long lead up to the confession and then suddenly them being together. Whereas now I appreciate when stories get that over with, like, satisfyingly, but relatively fast, so you get to actually see them in a relationship and how that changes the characters and how that plays out and how they deal with struggles together. Like, as an adult, that's more interesting to me. When you're, like, 12, you're not necessarily gonna get that far past that. Like, that is the biggest thing you can kind of imagine, is, like, actually telling someone your feelings and they say yes, and then your brain kind of, that's sort of where it ends in your mind. So I can see how that maybe was more satisfying to, you know, actual contemporaries of the characters.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that. Like, what you're saying is actually kind of interesting. Maybe not everyone's experience, but definitely an interesting thing to think about in terms of, like, kid lit. Like, that is wise. But that still, mm-hmm. there's a difference between, like, not really having a lot of the story be post-confession and dragging out getting to that confession the way that they did. There were other elements in yeah. this plot that could be keeping them away from each other that is not just being constantly interrupted.
Yeah, 100%. On an unrelated note, I think Tomoyo and Naoko should date. They could make spectacular movies together.
I agree.
So, I have some thoughts on how this could have been better. Some more thoughts, I guess. So, first off, the plot of the play is that, like Romeo and Juliet, a princess and prince from warring kingdoms fall in love. Wouldn't it have been interesting if there had been some sort of parallel between Shaodan's family and Sakura's? Maybe they wanted the cards back! Also, wouldn't it have been more interesting if the disappearances were somehow tied to Sakura feeling her feelings for Shaodan? That every time she thought about him, something disappeared?
Yes, it would have. That would have been tight and creepy and dramatic, and explain why she'd have to put off confessing to Shaodan.
Also, is Hope a Pandora's Box reference?
Oh, it's gotta be. And I really like that element, since the anime actually has a Pandora's Box motif with us seeing Sakura release all the cards at the very beginning. Like, I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree. But okay, this climax was dumb. It relied on Shaodan, for some reason, paying the price for stealing the card, losing his most important feeling. The reason was because Sakura's powers were drained, his registered as more powerful. But when has that ever mattered? And maybe I misunderstood, but what? Even in the anime, where other people can get glow cards, unlike the manga where that just wasn't a thing, it wasn't down to who was most powerful. It was who did the most work to defeat the card. Sakura still had to be the one to seal them, so I guess that follows this pattern. And Shaodan did manage to use thunder against the sealed card, but I don't think that was really what led to its defeat. It just seemed unnecessary and kind of illogical that they did this.
Yeah, it was a lot of fridge logic. Like, everything about this was very fridge logic, including the, like, oh, and secretly there was another card the whole time we didn't know about. And you're just like, oh, no. This is really cool. Like, that idea, that concept is really strong. I mean, it feels like a cool Nanase Okawa concept, right? Like, the idea that there's a card that balances it out, that there's this one final, most powerful, difficult thing, like, that's really neat, and I really, really like that element, but it was not seeded from the very beginning. It feels like a thing that's just in a movie to be dramatic. Like, why would Ariel not know? Yeah, like, I gotta say, like, nothing about this movie really flowed organically. It feels like it was written in haste during grueling scheduling for everyone involved, and I wouldn't hold it against anyone, because it's, like, kind of beautifully made anyway, and the ideas are really interesting, but it is a bit of a drag to rewatch. Sorry.
Yeah, and you sort of touched on this, but seriously, why did Ariel allow that house to be destroyed if it was sealing a card? Like, the plot did not imply that this was another lesson from Ariel, which would have made sense, honestly. So he just sold off this expensive and seemingly important mansion to some developers for no reason? Like, even if he didn't remember that, wouldn't he have wanted to keep this house?
Yeah, look, it's... I think that there are so many elements that are really interesting in this, and like you said, like, there are cool ideas, like, there's places where parallels could have been really easily drawn, like, it's sort of like all the pieces are on the table, and they just did not do the final draft that it needed. But, that being said, like, the nothing was really sad, and the solution where she, you know, brings it all together and creates, like, the Hope card and that, like, that Pandora's box aspect. Really inspired and cool. Like, there's some really, really neat ideas in here. And oh my god, Lucy, we are almost done with the Cardcaptor Sakura anime. Like, I'm sorry, I cannot wait to read a comic and talk about comics, a thing I actually know a lot about. And it's also going to be a really good one.
Oh my god, I know, but not so fast. In our next episode, we'll be discussing the dubs with special guest and our Cardcaptors correspondent, Caitlin Like. We know many of you have fond memories of Cardcaptors, and we'd love to include your thoughts in this episode. You can email us at clampcastpod@gmail.com or use the contact form on our website, clampcastinwonderland.com.
Until then, you can follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, Blue Sky, Threads, and Instagram at clampcastpod, and on Facebook as Clampcast in Wonderland. We currently don't update super regularly, but we try to post whenever a new episode is live, at least.
At this moment, it feels like Blue Sky might be winning the various Twitter replacement battles, at least for us, so that might be the most reliable one. We'll see. You can also support us on Patreon by making purchases through our bookshop.org store or just by writing a review or sharing this podcast with your friends.
Thanks for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember that everything will definitely be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.